The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Knoll, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. As such, we take on some very serious issues that are generally not explored in any meaningful or objective way by the mainstream media. We also invite people who generally are not regular faces in the mainstream media, but who have very specific insights. Today, the topic, America's War on Drugs, a failure for domestic policies and international relations. Our first guest, is Professor Bruce Bagley. Professor Bagley is a professor of political science at the University of Miami's Department of International Studies. He is also its chairperson. Over the years, he has specialized in globalization, the war on drugs and drug trafficking, Latin American politics and security issues. He is also co-editor of the Journal of Inter-American Studies and World Affairs. He serves as an adjunct professor at another institute in Colombia, and in the past was an assistant professor in the School of Advanced International Studies, Johns Hopkins University. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
For many people, we just don't think about a war on drugs. It's not on anyone's agenda. It's not on any of the talking points for candidates in elections. But in spite of it not being something we talk about, it certainly has a way of impacting us. We have anywhere between 2.1 and 2.4 million Americans incarcerated at any given time. We also have had, now then think of the number of people that would impact, generally in the neighborhood of about 5 people per family. So you're talking about 12 million families. We also have had at least 7.5 million people previously incarcerated. Now you're talking about 35 million. So now we're up to around 45 million people who have been incarcerated. The largest single percentage of those are for drug-related crimes. At any given time, we will have a politician telling us why that we should get tougher on drugs. We then hear about Mexico and what our we call them narco-terrorists, though others would prefer narco-criminals, because their main intent is not terrorism as such, but it's rather pure unmitigated greed and using any method of violence necessary to maintain their positions and control over their market. 48,000 on the very low end, and many suggest that it's as high as 100,000 dead since the president, Calderon, made an official war on drugs in that country with our support, billions of dollars we've given. There was a time when many Americans that I know were going to retire down to Panama or to one of the other beautiful tropical paradises in Central or South America. Costa Rica was very popular. And then came the reality that Colombia was not the only place that was the epicenter of cocaine dealing and growing and transport. And then the whole entire scourge of the criminal element behind these drugs moved north. So virtually all of Central and South America is now today in some way impacted. America's answer is simple, and the American media has parroted this. Militarize. Militarize more of your police. Bring in more of our high-tech drones and surveillance, and get tough on them. Then we have, I'm laying these all out as a picture, and then from this picture I'm laying out, I'm going to ask you to take us as in detail as you want, without any interruption from me, in your what you see as the defining issues we should discuss and know about in ways that the average person wouldn't know that there are some solutions, and possibly what I believe is decriminalization of all this. In any case, an adjunct to this is the privatization of our prisons, where groups of lobbyists have descended upon policymakers and governors, given them large amounts of campaign money, providing that they push for more privatizing of the jails and getting longer prison terms for the prisoners, including drug-related. Another side of this issue is Afghanistan, arguably one of the largest places in the world that's growing poppy, used as heroin. And yet we had Colin Powell, at that time Secretary of State, giving large subsidies to the Northern Alliance, who were the warlords, who owned these fields and profit immensely from them, who took our money and continued to grow poppies. And yet we've had this unsavory relationship, a kind of a hypocritical relationship. We're really tough on people that smoke marijuana or use crack or methamphetamine. But if we, the United States government, happens to have allies who are in Afghanistan or Pakistan or Iraq, and they happen to be growing poppies, well, we'll look the other way. And people are confused, much like Vietnam and the Golden Triangle. So that said, no one ever talks about what it's like to be a kid that is put in jail for possessing some drugs, and how that system alters their life. It's as if we had this very moralistic position, we don't care. If you committed the crime, do the time, your fault, not ours. And I'm saying, hold on a second. Let's stop for a moment and just dissect this enormous problem, because you've had now 40 years of an official war on drugs. You've had 40 years as an official war on cancer. The war on cancer has become a medical Vietnam, no victory. And I don't see any gains in the war on drugs except ruining an awful lot of lives. The forum is yours. Take us through it step by step. Dissect this. Let us know why each piece of this dissected puzzle is important for us to understand.
Well, you've laid out quite a broad panorama, and it might take us actually a very long time to be able to sort of do justice to each of those parts. But let me give it an effort here. From my perspective, the U.S. war on drugs, the U.S.-led war on drugs, which is 40 years old if you start with Richard Nixon, 1971. You could actually begin before, because the Harrison Act of 1914 began to make all of these drugs illegal. I wrote an article called The New 100 Years War at one point, which I thought was basically an optimistic article, because after 100 years, from 1914 to 2014, I thought that we would recognize that these efforts that we have had to, in effect, suppress production or eradicate production abroad, to interdict the flow of drugs into the United States, and to incarcerate people who run afoul of our anti-drug laws, would run its course, and that we would realize that we had expended a huge amount of money and a huge effort in a failed war on drugs. Not only a failed war on drugs, but one that's counterproductive. Indeed, I estimate that we've spent roughly $1 trillion in the last 40 years. That's money that we could have spent in other ways. $1 trillion that has not solved our problem at home, and has only allowed the problems abroad to become deeper and more serious as we contaminate country after country. The war on drugs is not simply a failure, it's counterproductive, and it's siphoned off resources from the United States, this $1 trillion that I'm mentioning. We spend roughly $20 billion a year at the federal level, another $20 billion a year at the state level. We require countries around the globe to expend their scarce resources on all of this, and to, in the process, generate huge amounts of violence. Let's start at home. In the United States, as you mentioned, we have roughly 2.3 million people in jail at any given time, a large number of people out of jail on parole. Of those 2.3 million people, which is the largest number of people in jail of any country in the world, at least 600,000 or more are in jail for what are essentially victimless crimes. marijuana smoking and these kinds of things. The smaller numbers are in jail for trafficking or more violent related crimes. The consequences for society are that we spend, in a state like California, $49,000 per year per person that we jail, that we warehouse. The state of California is under court order right now to either build $6 billion worth of new prisons, release 20% of the prison population because of overcrowding, or send them to other states where they would be incarcerated. In a state like Louisiana, where a prisoner per year costs roughly $30,000, you get a slightly better deal, so California is beginning to send them out. But the bottom line is we're expending a huge amount of money. The poverty level for a family of four in the United States is $22,500 a year. We could, for the price that it costs us to incarcerate one person for a drug-related crime in the state of California, a nonviolent, often victimless crime, we could support a family, two families of four, at or slightly above the poverty level. We are expending these resources and we are destroying especially young people's lives. We've already sacrificed one generation. We're probably sacrificing another, because once young people are placed into the prison system, convicted and placed in the prison system, they are felons. They come out with a felony record. We all know what that means in terms of future employment. Many people in the United States do not know that young people are denied loans to go back to school from the federal government. They can't get access to them. They can't get access to public housing. They can't get professional credentials or licenses, whether it's on Wall Street or to operate heavy machinery or airplanes or anything else. We are sacrificing that group. Once we send these people into prison, we're sending them into schools for scoundrels. We are, in essence, making them increasingly less adaptable to the needs of our modern American society. That kind of policy, in my opinion, is a fundamental error and one that we need to correct. We need to begin to think about juvenile courts that don't give people felony records, that don't send them to jail on the first and second offenses if they are not involved in violent crimes with arms and other things. If these are not violent crimes, then we should at first attempt to restore them, send them back to school, demand that they undertake a vocational training, and if necessary, psychological training, and we should make that available to them. So we have not dealt effectively with the youth population or demand. We have not invested, as we should, in effective programs of prevention and education. The RAND Corporation has estimated that investments in education and prevention are 15 times more effective than supply-side controls trying to stamp out drugs abroad or even in the state of California, or trying to interdict them. And yet we spend 70% of all of our money on that. We need to reorient these policies and have more youth-friendly, because youth are the people who do most of the drugs. You're introduced into drugs usually by peer pressure, not by dealers, starting in your early teens or even preteens. By the time you're in your late 20s, most people have, you know, run the course with drugs. They have families. They need to go to work, earn money, you know, keep a job. So that we're really concerned mostly with teenagers and 20-somethings. We could do much better on prevention and education. We could do much better by not jailing them, and it would be far cheaper, even if we don't consider issues like decriminalization. So on the first point, we need to address the issues of demand in a more upfront fashion. Where we do have problems of addiction, or by the way, alcoholism, we need to begin to address those problems through programs of treatment and rehabilitation, which would be a far better way to spend our money than trying to warehouse people in our prison system and make them essentially non-citizens once they get out. when people do get out, they're on parole and they can be easily violated and thrown back into jail, and that very often happens. But we have no programs for their adaptation into our society. In fact, we deny them the wherewithal to go back to school and do those kinds of things. It's more likely if you are a young black man in the state of Florida between the ages of 18 and 25 that you will end up in the prison system than you will in the university system in the state where I currently live. That's completely unacceptable, in my opinion. It's anti-American. It's not the way that we should be going about dealing with these kinds of problems. So demand is the first area that we have to look at, and what we do with people who are caught up in it. We also need fundamental prison reform. We are warehousing far too many people at far too great a cost. And indeed, if there's a ray of light here, it's not at the national level where the debate has been frozen, where there is virtually any time any politician on the center or the left raises his voice and says perhaps we should reconsider our drug policy and our so-called war on drugs. Basically, they lose all their funding, they lose the electorate, and then they lose their positions. So there's been no debate at the national level. Where the debate is taking place in the United States with regard to the drug issue is not, you know, in the Republican debates that we have been seeing in 2011 and 12. It's not even in the Democratic Party at the national level. It's taking place at the state level. The Proposition 19 to legalize marijuana in 2010 came forward because California can no longer afford the kinds of incarceration policies that this war on drugs has led us to. All 50 states are broke and undergoing a fiscal crisis. They need to find alternatives that are both cheaper and more effective. That kind of experimentation has therefore led states to begin to think about alternatives, and that's a positive sign, to not jail people, to think about programs of prevention and education, treatment and rehabilitation before we think about making our young people into felons. Prison reform that would involve youth courts, right, and alternatives to jail time would be significant advances. So if we could begin to look more effectively at demand on the one hand and on at prisons on the other, we could go a long way towards reducing both the fiscal burden and the severe human damage that we're doing to youth in general, and especially to minority youth and poor youth around this country, because blacks are 10 times more likely to be thrown into jail for drug-related crimes than middle-class white kids are. We haven't been able to do that for some pretty basic reasons. There is a kind of ideological or even religious consensus in our country against, sort of being more flexible and adopting more pragmatic policies towards drugs. We tried to prohibit alcohol once, and we backed away from it, in part because there are several religions that don't prohibit alcohol. But every major religion, you know, Catholicism, Christianity in all of its variations, Protestantism, the Jewish faith, and the Muslim faith, they all are down on drugs. So that background of a kind of ideological, almost religious or puritanical consensus is reinforced by fear-mongering, especially among the middle class, and it's the middle class that fears that John and Jane, right, will end up in, their kids will end up in schools. It's led us to adopt draconian policies about selling drugs within 1,000 yards of schools that basically, you know, send people away and up the river for 10 years or more. That fear among the middle class, which began with the crack boom, has simply deepened in this country. And if you combine that with the way in which we go about our elections, particularly for the House of Representatives, where we reelect all 435 every 2 years, and we have had a kind of constant auction. If, you know, 10-year mandatory sentences are not enough to stop the drug plague in the United States, then politicians, instead of rethinking that policy, say, no, maybe we should make them 15 years minimum mandatories. We had 100 times more severe penalties for crack than we did for powdered cocaine, although you can make crack out of powdered cocaine in your kitchen, and people do. We have reduced those under Obama, but only partially. There's still 8 to 10 times more severe penalties for the poor man's form of cocaine than there is for powdered cocaine. So those are two really critical issues at home in the United States There are other dimensions. We need far more community-based policing. We need far more recreational opportunities. We need to have the possibility of offering youth both jobs and education and hope in their lives, and we have been failing as a society in doing that. The same kind of obdurate or stubborn attitude to stick with a policy that has failed and has been counterproductive here at home, which has not reduced, right, in any significant way the societal and economic costs that we're paying, is reproduced abroad. The United States has been, you know, conducting this war on drugs. It has been leading the effort for some 40 years. And there are sort of three basic truths that you can see occurring in the parts of the world that I study most closely, especially Latin America. The first is that we have seen a constant balloon effect in terms of areas of cultivation or growing of the drugs that are considered illicit, specifically coca leaf and heroin, and to a lesser extent, of course, marijuana. In 1985, to give you an example, 65% of all coca leaf that is used to convert that is used to make cocaine, refined cocaine or powdered cocaine, was grown in Peru. 65% in 1985. 25% was grown in Bolivia. With the advent of the war on drugs and its push forward over the 1980s and into the 1990s, we shifted the areas of growing from the southern Andes, particularly Peru and Bolivia, northwards to Colombia, so that by the year 2000, Colombia was growing 90% of all the coca leaf. Now that we have pushed very hard through Plan Colombia since 2000 on Colombia, we're seeing the resurgence of coca growing once again in Peru and Bolivia. We haven't solved the problem. We've just ballooned it out into new areas and then back. There's an ebb and flow in this process. The overall production of coca leaf and of cocaine has remained relatively constant for the last 30 years. It responds much more to demand than it does to the government efforts such as those of the United States or governments that work with us to suppress it. So the balloon effect has spread the problem around South America and contaminated country after country. There's a second effect of this war on drugs. We very often, in a kind of whack-a-mole game, go after the drug cartels in Colombia. The famous ones were Medellin and Cali, the Norte del Valle cartel in the western part of the country. Those cartels have been largely cut down to size or eliminated, but new ones have proliferated. In Colombia, there are now 300. And by pushing on these cartel organizations and cutting them down to size, we achieve some good things. I think it's important not to allow major cartels to challenge the national security of governments or to terrorize entire countries. But we have driven these organizations from one country to another. So we focus on Colombia. And then there is what I call the dispersal effect, or I sometimes label it the cockroach effect. When you go into a kitchen, say of a student at the University of Miami, and flick on the lights at night and they haven't cleaned up, the cockroaches run out of the room. Where do they go? They go into the next room. They go into the next apartment. In my analogy, they go from Colombia into other countries. And so we have driven through this cockroach effect, organized crime, northwards towards Mexico. Over the last few years of the 1990s and much of the first decade of the 2000s, we saw the cockroach effect driving organized crime northwards to Mexico. The United States in 2008 adopted the so-called Merida Initiative. We combined forces with the president of Mexico, Felipe Calderon, who had decided at our urging to militarize the struggle in Mexico since December 1st, 2006 when he took office. He's about to leave office on December 1st, 2012. And of course, the problem is worse than ever. He didn't solve it in Mexico. Mexico, and the Merida Initiative, which has cost the United States several billions after we spent $8 billion on the Plan Colombia in Colombia to drive them northwards, we're now driving some of the organized crime groups out of Mexico, but they're going to Guatemala. They're going into Honduras in Central America. So we now are confronting the need to send American troops and drones, by the way, into Central America in states that are teetering on the brink of narco states, such as Guatemala. But it doesn't stop there. The Merida Initiative and the Calderon efforts, combined with those of the United States, are driving the cocaine traffic that surged from Colombia northwards back out of Mexico into Central America, back into Colombia, where there is renewed violence and surging drug trafficking organizations. They've also increasingly contaminated Venezuela under Chavez, who has either looked the other way or possibly condoned some of this. 52% of all the refined cocaine that goes to Europe now, which is a booming market, goes through Venezuela. Ecuador has been contaminated, and we're seeing the recontamination of the Caribbean countries, everything from the Dominican Republic and Haiti to Puerto Rico and Cuban territorial waters. So rather than stop this process by spending these billions, actually $1 trillion, what we have done is push it around. We played a kind of whack-a-mole game in which we declare victory in Peru and it moves to Colombia. Then we declare victory through Plan Colombia in Colombia. We drive it north to Mexico, and we are currently in the beginning of 2012, beginning to declare partial victories in Mexico, and we're seeing it flow back through the balloon and cockroach effects into Central America. And you can bet your bottom dollar that the United States is now gearing up for major programs and major expenditures in Central America. We haven't even considered the fact that consumption, alongside this process of organized crime spreading around, has also grown. Well, the United States has had some success with prevention and education. We could have a lot more if we actually expended those resources. Consumption of cocaine, and that's the drug that I'm focusing on most right now, has been globalized. The second largest cocaine-consuming country in the world today is Brazil. 20 years ago, Brazil hardly knew what cocaine was. The third is Argentina. The fourth is Spain. The European Union consumes almost as much cocaine today as does the United States, which is an incredible expansion of cocaine consumption in Europe. And by the way, they pay three times the price that we pay in the United States per gram or per metric ton. This process of pushing around the drug trade without coming to grips with either the cultivation and the peasant populations, right, that are involved in that because they have no alternatives, the refiners and the traffickers, right, that simply move from country to country, has continued the flow of drugs into the United States despite our efforts, and has continued to produce a constant stream of young people who experiment with drugs, and rather than being receiving treatment or receiving education opportunities and other kinds of recreational opportunities, we simply throw them into jail. This entire process, not only a failure in the war on drugs, it's been counterproductive for United States interests at home, for the next generation of Americans, and it's cost us an arm and a leg. Well, we have basically sacrificed country after country in South America, and by the way, abroad, there are 11 states in Africa that are now caught up in this. The president of Guinea-Bissau was just shot down because he was probably caught involved with drug trafficking organizations and on the take, but we're seeing it around the globe. It undermines democracy. It destabilizes country after country. And by the way, in many areas, provides opportunities for terrorist organizations to take advantage of the drug trade and the money laundering that goes on and finance their activities. That's exactly what the Taliban has been doing, and to some extent Al-Qaeda previously, in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, which the United States has occupied with American troops since 2001, produces 93% of the world's refined heroin. That's after 10 years of American troops in Afghanistan. Our militarization of Afghanistan hasn't worked, and it is, you know, increasingly destroyed that country. Well, heroin continues to flow out of Afghanistan through Central Asia and Russia into Europe, expanding consumption all along the trail, or through Pakistan. And it has financed the Haqqani networks and has financed the Pakistani Taliban and other groups. We simply have not been able to get a grip on that problem either. The idea that the war on drugs has been successful is borders on the ludicrous. It has, in fact, produced exactly the results that any rational actor would see as counterproductive and would lead us to reassess what we have been doing. But given our institutional electoral cycle where we re-elect 435 members of the House of Representatives each year and they simply engage in a kind of hardline auction to see who can throw more people in jail for longer periods of time, no matter what the costs to the young people are, no matter what the costs to society are, is simply the wrong way to go. Mexico is one of the very best examples. Mexico, after the Colombians were with the assistance of the United States through Plan Colombia, able to drive some of the criminal organizations out of Colombia, certainly not all of them, and there is the resurgence I mentioned. Mexico, over the last 10 years, has borne the brunt of the war on drugs. The government estimates that well over 45, now close to 50,000 have died. There are independent estimates of 100,000, as you mentioned, who have died, and that doesn't even begin to address the issues of loss of economic growth potential, the hopelessness of the young people that are thrown in jail in places like Mexico, the random violence and insecurity that plagued that country and that continue to plague it today. Under these circumstances, it seems to me that it's long beyond the time when we should consider the consequences of this 100 years war or the last 40 years of the modern phase of the war on drugs, that we should begin to look for solutions that work. There are a lot of people who absolutely oppose legalization of drugs in any form. Decriminalization is an intermediate part of it, especially if there are young people involved in nonviolent crimes. We should think about alternatives to jail for them. It would be cheaper, it would be wiser, and it would be more humane to do that. But there has been no flexibility. Perhaps we'll see better and greater experimentation at the state level, but to date, there has been a block or a break on any kind of innovation in our policies. And if the United States is not willing to experiment, then other countries find it very difficult because we are so large and so powerful that we can intimidate other countries into backing away from anything that smacks of depenalization or being soft on drugs. Even though we have seen in the last couple of years, most recently at the end of 2011, reports backed by increasing numbers of prominent Latin American politicians, former President Fernando Henrique Cardoso of Brazil, former President Cesar Gaviria of Colombia, former President Ernesto Zedillo of Mexico, joined by former Secretary of State George Shultz and many others who have said that it's time to reorient our drug policies towards solutions that work for young people, that work for the societies that are involved, that work towards deepening democracy, not undermining it and corroding it. And we have begun to see, even among our allies in Latin America, President Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia, who took office in 2010, just last week said that the war on drugs in his country, which has cost Colombia so much blood and so much treasure, has been like riding a stationary bicycle. They've gone nowhere, and he wants to rethink it. President Calderon, at the end of his six-year term, called the sexenio, in Mexico, which will end at the end of in 2012 after elections in July, has also come forward and said perhaps it's time to rethink this. Even our closest allies, the ones that have paid the heaviest price to work with the United States in the war on drugs, are now arguing from the presidencies of their countries that it's time to rethink it. In Brazil, in Colombia, in Mexico, there are alternative ways of looking at these problems, right? Of addressing the difficulties that youth encounter with drugs, and I'm by no means advocating heroic drugs for everybody. I don't want people driving down the street stoned. I don't want them killing me or my family, and if people operate automobiles just like drunks operating cars under the influence of alcohol, they should probably go to jail. But if it's a victimless crime without violence, then we should think of alternatives because we could afford it better and it would be better for the people, right, who are caught up with these kinds of problems. We should make treatment available on demand. We should make rehabilitation an important part of this. Even though rehabilitation very often confronts difficulties because it's a tough process, we should think about rehabilitation as a way of keeping people out of jail and away from committing crimes, because while they're in rehabilitation programs, they don't commit crimes. And we should invest in our youth by investing in prevention and education programs from pre-kinder on at levels that they can deal with throughout primary and high school, throughout college, and by the way, for the generation that has graduated from college and is in their 20s that still is caught up in this and where they have very often the greatest problems with addiction. We would be doing the United States a favor by undertaking those kinds of reassessments about what works best and what doesn't work, what costs the most and produces the least result. We would also be doing many countries in the Western Hemisphere a great favor, because we have often been in the position of arguing that we are willing to fight to the last Colombian or willing to fight to the last Mexican in this war on drugs, but we've never been willing to fight to the last American.
Dr. Begley, that's a good introduction, 40 minutes without a break. When was the last time you were in an interview on a radio program with a large audience where they allowed you to talk uninterrupted for 40 minutes?
Never. Okay, but I just did a radio program a little earlier in Minnesota a couple of days ago. Well, they only allowed me to talk for a short period of time, but you gave me license.
That's correct, and I am going to continue, but I want to introduce a few more talking points, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Do you believe in parity? Do you believe in equality?
Absolutely.
Okay, then if that's the case, then why is it in New York City young white women and men smoke marijuana at a higher rate than their black and brown counterparts, yet the New York Police Department is 700% more likely to arrest a young black person and nearly 400% as likely to arrest a young Latino for marijuana possession? Also in L.A. County, less than 10% are black, but more than 30% of those arrested for marijuana possession are African American. And right now, as of today, you have 81.6% of those who are arrested for possession, 18.4% for sale and manufacturing. And the possession is where you're getting directly at your nonviolent. Now, a few ideas, and then I'd like for you to dissect my ideas, please.
Sure.
I believe that we cannot win any war on anything until we first understand the progenitor, the underlying foundation. First, we're not having a national dialogue outside of the realms of the self-righteous religious fanatics and the political parasites that feed off them. Just asking people, why do you want drugs? Let's just understand. One of the largest groups of people using drugs today are not the youth, they're senior citizens. And we're not talking about why would a senior citizen be using drugs. When you think of drugs, you think someone may be a teenager, not someone over 65. Yet the statistics actually support senior citizens, the number one use. Number two, if a person commits a crime, is it any less a crime if they weren't caught for it? Just a quick yes or no.
No.
Okay, so if you commit a crime and you're not caught, if you rob a bank and you didn't get caught, the fact that you tell someone you robbed a bank doesn't exonerate you from having robbed the bank, right?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so then the people that are caught committing a crime and are sentenced without any mercy or any compassion or any spirituality, including those who profess to be Christians, I wonder what they would do if Christ were caught with smoking weed today. Would they put him in jail? I know Ann Coulter would, but I don't, and Bill O'Reilly would admonish him. Guilt-ridden Catholic he is. But here's a question. Why don't we ask President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton, all of whom use drugs, to go and voluntarily, since they didn't get caught, aren't they as equally guilty of violating the law? Shouldn't they spend some time in jail? I'm just a yes or no.
Well, I mean, statute of limitations.
No, that's not what I'm asking.
In jail for smoking marijuana.
I understand.
So I wouldn't want to put President Obama, President Clinton, or President Bush, right, in jail for having done that. I think we have to go the other way.
Okay, but nor would I. My point is an allegorical point.
Sure, they're equally guilty. They did it. And haven't they been able to modify these laws? President Obama has done something. But basically, the coalition that I mentioned that is absolutely opposed, right, to any kind of flexibility at all, and given our political system and the way that our elections run, and by the way the Senate, allows a minority to paralyze things, we simply have been able to make no progress at all. The progress that's being made is being made in medicinal marijuana. It's being made in states like California that are being crushed by the fiscal burden.
Okay, just hold your thoughts for 1 second. I'm going to let you talk and interrupt in a moment again.
Sure.
But on that point alone, President Obama, Justice Department, has said that it doesn't matter if you have a state law that decriminalizes the use marijuana, medical marijuana use, we will supersede that because federal law supersedes state law. So that shows me a lot about the true background of these people. My point was, shouldn't all the people who've used marijuana not got caught? If they all went to jail, you wouldn't have but about 15 people left out of jail, and especially the politicians and a lot of the religious leaders as well, no matter when they did it. So being sanctimonious and self-righteous is easy when you're not the one who was caught and you're not the one doing the time and your life turned upside down for it. Now, my three ideas are this. A, I don't believe that we can deal with drugs until we de-ghettoize America. We have placed zero emphasis upon on doing this. The money always goes to the bankers, the corporations, or the corporations associated with the contractors associated with the major industries or the governmental agencies. Nothing goes into inner city. Secondly, my friends in Europe, in Ireland, in Greece, are telling me that where you used to be able to walk down a street in Athens and enjoy your evening, enjoy an outside dinner at 9, 10 o'clock at night, today you don't do that. A, the youth are so impoverished. The stores have been closed down. The jobs they once had don't exist, so they're relying upon drugs just to provide food for their family, and that has also led to drug competition and gangs and violence. That's everywhere in Europe. It's also true in the United States. 5 years ago, there were approximately 68,000 known, clearly an understatement, members of gangs in the United States. Today, it's over 1.5 million. Now, with the economy going on a really slippery slope down for about 240 million Americans, but everything looking up and good for about 70 million Americans, what you're going to have is you're going to have more young people who would never join a gang, would never distribute drugs, doing so simply for economic survival. And yet now we're going to take these young children, we're going to take these kids, and we're going to criminalize them, or we're going to put them into Homeland Security's database of terrorists. Because
we view,
the United States government views gangs as terrorist organizations, not just criminal organizations. So then that's going to cause a blowback. We also, and lastly, we never ask the question, why is ALEC, the big group of corporate entities that lobby state legislators to get the governors and the legislators in the states to pass laws that work for them or rescind laws or alter laws or regulations that work against them, why haven't we shown their dirty hand, their complicit hand, in making drug laws stricter? Now, my suggestion would be this, and then I'll be quiet and let you give your points of view. I believe that we could handle drugs if we, A, decriminalize all possession. B, in every city in the United States, go into the areas where drug interdiction is necessary. And by the way, I was in Camden, New Jersey, filming for a new documentary, and I was speaking with a lot of people using drugs. There are 200 open-air drug markets in Camden, New Jersey. 200. And anyhow, they said, you know, this is the only way we can buy anything. But what if we went in there and we started to have homes for people who are having problems with drugs and need help, psychological help, physical help, detoxification, and did that inside the inner city. Got psychologists, behaviorists, sociologists, nutritionists, people who can help people. And then if instead of taking the existing penalty system, give people a chance to do community service, helping rehabilitate buildings, plant gardens, community parks. So in effect, you're changing the ghetto. You're changing who is the most victimized in it, the people living there, which we never think about, and also changing around. Then also have a plan to get a lot of people who have problems with drugs into the country. Get them as part of a new civil conservation corps, but get them to go out and reforest America. Help them work wherever their talent lies in planting trees, but at the same time have communities where people in the country can learn organic garden, can detoxify. We've never tried that. We've certainly done civil conservation work, and it worked beautifully to help to rebuild the infrastructure of America. And based upon a person's talents, you could put them either in the inner city or in the country. It would do an awful lot to help with our infrastructure and outside the cities and the urban environment to stop its decay and rot and rehabilitate it. Also, we should be putting a greater emphasis upon tutorials and to help children get back into school, get their education, and get the help they need. If we did that, instead of criminalizing it, then you take away the incentive. If there's no profit to be made, then the gangs are not interested in it. The gangs will do something else, but drugs aren't it. And drugs is the number one way throughout the world that gangs make their money. The Taliban makes its money through the poppies. So if we learned a lesson by getting rid of the prohibition on alcohol, which caused the growth of organized crime, and treated the person at an educational level, if you're going to do drugs, tell us why, and is there anything else that we could do to help you so that you did not end up hurting yourself, your loved ones, or society in the process, and then treat it as a condition that has positive outcomes instead of throwing them in jail. A, that doesn't stop them from being a drug addict. There's as much drugs that can be gotten in jail as out. B, it only re-solidifies that society doesn't like me, so when I come out, I'm going to beat up on someone, hurt someone, kill someone. And thirdly, it doesn't change a single thing. All we've done is, if we're rich and powerful, as about 70 million Americans are, not 1%, 70 million. 70 million is not 1%. We're closer to about 35% of Americans are really the people who are the more elites. You have your super elites, but then you have the people who are doing very nicely and will continue to. If they only understood what it was like to be on the other end of a sentence, be on the other end of a teenager in a juvenile detention center or an orphanage or in a gang. But we don't want to know that story. It scares us. So we pay attention to Jersey Shore and all the kind of terribly vulgar and demeaning reality television. And I'm thinking, wow, where are our priorities? Where's our spirituality? Where is our compassion? Those are my thoughts. Continue with yours.
I mean, basically, I agree with much of what you said. I think that there's clear discrimination against minorities in the United States, by the way, in other societies, but especially in the United States, against blacks, Hispanics, and other groups, in drug policies and drug arrests and in drug sentencing. This is in part because they are... because of racial discrimination. It is in part because they are poor and are underrepresented and have very few alternatives and never have spokesmen for them. De-ghettoizing the United States is a great idea, but let's not get utopian. You know, I think that there are ways that we can minimize the impact on the minority populations. And I am specifically an advocate of decriminalization. I do not advocate, you know, heroin addiction or anything for society in general, but I think we should treat this as a public health problem, that we should engage in harm reduction policies rather than compounding the difficulties of the society and the individuals confront by jailing large numbers of them. In terms of your alternatives about organic gardening and vocational training, I think that they're great ideas. We have to adjust and adapt in various parts of the country, some for urban settings, some for rural settings. One formula, you know, is not sufficient for all. One shoe doesn't fit all. But I am more than in agreement that what we need to do is provide alternatives to young people other than jail, that we have to engage in programs of education, rehabilitation, treatment, vocational training. We have to provide opportunities for these young people, or we are simply condemning them to that kind of life. You know, it's all well and good to talk about, you know, throwing former presidents in jail, but the fact of the matter is that somewhere between 70 and 90 million Americans who smoke marijuana. There's a great deal of hypocrisy in all of this. My notion here is that we should not be putting people in jail for nonviolent crimes. We should be seeking other alternatives. It's better for society. It's better for the individual. It's crazy to spend $49,000 per prisoner. So I couldn't agree more. I don't think President Obama or President Bush, you know, George W. Bush should have gone to jail simply for that. I don't think 70 or 90 million Americans should go to jail, and I don't think these young people should go to jail for it. I think that we are engaged in a counterproductive policy.
I agree, but let me interject one thing. It is my contention that if the President of the United States chose to draw a line in the sand and say, no more of this, we're not putting anyone else in jail because of drugs, we're going to help them, we're going to have a program of interdiction in a constructive way in their homes, in the schools, in society at all levels. Remember, an awful lot of those white, upper middle class or wealthy kids go into Camden to get their drugs and then take it back. Go into South.
Take them back, sure, they buy them in the ghetto, that's why the violence is concentrated in the barrios and the ghettos. But look,
otherwise it's hypocritical, and I believe we could have done a lot more if any of these people would have had the courage to take this on and realize there's a lot of progressive minds that would have supported them.
I think there are a lot of progressive minds, and I'm all for it. In fact, I've worked a long time on this. But I don't think presidents can do it. And let me just say, President Obama, in his health care reform, with all of the problems and the lack of a single payer and all the rest of that, produced incredible opposition. He's still producing incredible opposition. But one of the things that people have forgotten is that that new health care reform in the United States has addressed for the very first time in our history the issue of addiction. 31 million people are being included, and addiction is now part of that. It's not just alcohol addiction, it's also drug addiction. Those are steps forward. But no president has been able to wave a magic wand and do this. Indeed, many of them have waved their wands and gone in the opposite direction, despite the fact, like George W. Bush, they were themselves admitted alcoholics and drug addicts. Under these circumstances, we need to work towards policies that reduce harm, that do not inflict greater damage on this generation or the next, and that reduce the cost to society. And I think we've seen ways of doing that, and you mentioned some of them. I'm all for them. But we can't think that we're simply going to be able to wave a magic wand and solve these problems. We're going to have to work at this, and it's going to take years, but it's well worth doing.
I agree. Now, we're up to about 3 minutes left. I had a whole panel. You've taken the whole show. I'm blaming you.
Yes, you can blame me. Or you can edit out the irrelevant.
No. There hasn't been any irrelevance. You've been extremely generous with your intellect and your thoughts, and we appreciate it. Just your final thoughts. We have just 3 minutes, 2.5 minutes left in our program today. Give us what you believe should be the most important steps to take to start taking each part of this, because you must deal with the for-profit privatization of the prison system. You must take all the spy organizations, intelligence organizations, which are really private contractors for profit that have
and
had
lobbies.
And lobbyists. You've got to take them into consideration. You have to take those politicians that have aligned with the religious zealots who see, you know, who have that hard line attitude about drugs. Using any drug shows a moral weakness. take each of these pieces, not the least of which is the individual who is using the drugs. And we have 2 minutes. Tell us what you believe should be the first and second steps we should begin with.
Look, what drives the violence that surrounds the drug trade and the corruption abroad is money. We've got to reduce the profitability. So I am all for harm reduction policies that seek to endorse prevention and treatment, rehabilitation, education and rehabilitation, much more than I am for jailing people, and I think we have to start there. We have to recognize that. If we can take the money out of this, which includes, by the way, private guards' money and the lobbyists that they represent and sheriffs, right, offices that continue to lobby, then we could make a great deal of progress. But the bottom line here is that society, American society, must realize that we've been at this for 40 years in the modern phase, 100 years almost since the Harrison Act of 1914, and what we have done has failed. It's failed our youth. It's failed at the individual level because it hasn't solved the problem, and it's failed at the society level. We've got to change policies in a capitalist society because we are wasting money on a massive scale. We are not solving the problem. It's time to begin to address the problem by thinking about prevention, education, treatment, rehabilitation, community-based police, and we need to get away from the idea that other countries are going to solve a problem that is American. We cannot get them to stop producing drugs abroad if we can't get our society to move in ways that do not generate $150 billion a year more in profits. Those are the steps that we have to begin to think about, and I think there are people in the United States that are beginning to think about these things in very serious ways, and you know, the California initiative came close. We're going to see much more of that across this country in the next few years and in the next decade.
Thank you very much, Professor Bruce Bagley. We appreciate your input.
All right.
I'm Gary Nall. This was the Progressive Commentary Hour. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.